Blog Talk Radio.
Wydell, and this is our second episode of the Philip Nearing All Things Wing Chun podcast. First, I would like to say happy birthday to Sifu Nearing and hope you had a great birthday, and I hope you have many more, sir.
Well, thanks for the birthday greetings. Yeah, it was a good weekend, nice and quiet, spontaneous and under the radar, just the way I like them. Little Korean barbecue, take in a movie. I don't need too much entertainment. So, anyway, how are you tonight, Don?
I am good. Always great to hear your voice. And I know we wanted to start this episode with, in our second episode, please check out the first episode we did a couple of weeks ago. But we wanted to start out this episode with explaining what is Wing Chun.
Well, that's a loaded question. Actually, it's very simple. Wing Chun is a martial art from southern China, the Guangdong province, and specifically from around the town of Foshan, which was Yip Man's hometown. So he certainly came by his legacy of Wing Chun, or the learning Wing Chun, honestly. It's a town, Foshan is famous for traditional Chinese medicine. And also it's the hometown of Wang Fei Hung, who was a great martial artist and also was fictionalized a little bit, not unlike how the Ip Man movies are now. He's featured throughout, mangas, movies, you know, just since the dawn of cinema. So Wong Fei-hung was from Foshan, just as Ip Man. Well, anyway, back to Wing Chun. So the story goes, the Southern Shaolin Temple was burned down by the ruling dynasty, and the monks that were able fled, as did a Buddhist nun named Eng Mui. And Eng Mui was traveling through southern China, and she went to Foshan, and she saw a young girl who was working at her family's tofu stand, weeping. And so she said, "My child, why are you crying?" And she said, "Well, I have a boyfriend. We love each other. We want to marry. But there's this bandit that comes into town and he fancies me. And he said that he's going to take me for his own, and I don't want that." And so the Buddhist nun said, "Well, here's what we do. Go tell the guy that you'll see him in 6 months. You'll fight him. And if he wins, he can have you. If not, he has to leave town." So apparently he agreed to that, probably laughed a little bit. And so Eng Mui and the young girl went off to the mountains for 6 months, and she trained Wing Chun, or at least the art of Wing Chun. Actually, the young girl's name was Yim Wing Chun. And she came back down and tore the bandit up after 6 months of training and sent him packing. And she married her beloved, and she taught him the art of Wing Chun, and when she passed away, he named the art after her. So it's a charming story. You know, who knows if it's true? Most people suspect that it isn't. But I think, you know, the metaphor is very important that, A, this is a martial art that was created by a woman in a fairly patriarchal culture a couple of hundred years ago. And the metaphor being that if a smaller or less strong person learns how to avoid directly confronting force, to deflect, to change angle, change direction, and not clash force against force, strike to the vital areas with multiple blows, they can win a fight. They can certainly survive the situation. So my wife, who's also an avid Wing Chun practitioner and a very good fighter. She kind of got a little upset when I was questioning the veracity of the story, and she had a very important point that whoever developed Wing Chun, it had to have been developed by a smaller, less strong person, because to even think of that, you have to need to know how to do that. So what mm-hmm. chance does a smaller person have to survive? Well, technically, there are a number of things you can do. So Wing Chun is about economy of motion, economy of energy, and, of course, striking to the vital areas with multiple blows. If there's incoming force, you redirect it either by turning, deflecting, blocking, all of these sort of things. The whole system is about that. It's also about conservation of energy. It's not a hard style at all. There are elements of hard kung fu in Wing Chun, but it's relaxed. And we, of course, switch our energy on and off and use it when we need it. Really, not unlike, managing your money, managing your energy. If you don't need to spend the energy, don't. It was made famous in Hong Kong in the 50s and 60s, really a local reputation, as after the Maoist Revolution, Yip Man went to Hong Kong. He was from a wealthy family and had been a detective in Foshan, but he knew nobody really in Hong Kong. And one of his friends suggested that he teach the Restaurant Workers Union. So he taught several guys, about 20, 25, 30, from the looks of the pictures. And that was how he got his start teaching. And he lived humbly, but he spent the rest of his life teaching Wing Chun, developing Wing Chun fighters. Wing Chun made a huge name for itself in the Hong Kong rooftop fights. When you have a lot of people packed in a city, there has to be an outlet for the young people on some level. And there's not enough space to have too many soccer fields in Hong Kong, and, basketball courts are few and far between. But the young guys back in the day in the 50s, 60s loved kung fu, loved martial arts. And, of course, they'd try each other on any chance they possibly got. And there were a lot of reputations made then. Wong Shung Lung, Bruce Lee, William Chung, Chu Shong Tin, and an innumerable guys that would really defend the reputation of Wing Chun against other styles of kung fu. And these fights would take place on the rooftops, and they were pretty aggressive. Basically, the rules were minimal. No fatal strikes, of course. And other than no going to the eyes, but pretty much they were freewheeling fights, and they became quite interesting sporting events in the 50s and 60s in Hong Kong, and were covered by the press, and people probably gambled on them. So it was a very, very lively scene, and that's when Wing Chun came to the public attention. And of course, one of Yip Man's most famous student was Bruce Lee. And he went on to make a name for himself in film and television. And, if you don't know who Bruce Lee is, I'm sure
to
listen to this. So no need to go into all of that. this is where Wing Chun became a household word, really. Because people were wondering where he came from, what kind of martial art was this, and that's another show on Bruce Lee and where he went as a martial artist, and mm-hmm. That's somebody else's topic. But he certainly pointed right back to Wing Chun, and people were able to see what it was, became very interested in it, and it wasn't really very available, and. I think, I think that he passed away in the early 70s, as did Yip Man himself. And certainly by the end of the, the beginning of the 80s, you know, or earlier in some cities like San Francisco and New York. But in Chicago, the first real Wing Chun school didn't open up until 83. And that's actually where I got my start. It was quite popular in England, and it was quite because of the relationship between the English government and the colonial Hong Kong government. It was also very popular in Germany, as several Wing Chun instructors cultivated that and cultivated a market there for young Wing Chun people. So it went from being an obscure martial art from the from a small town like Foshan in Guangdong province to becoming one of the most widely spread martial arts in the world. I think only Tai Chi has made a larger impact on the world from China. Wing Chun is probably second to Tai Chi in terms of being disseminated around the world. So anyway, that hopefully that makes a little bit of sense.
Oh yeah. Definitely.
And it's go ahead.
Oh no, one of the things that I know that how I got into martial arts back in the 80s, late 70s and 80s because of Bruce Lee. I mean, he was so popular, and I didn't really know about Wing Chun until after college. And I wanted to ask, and you'll probably go headed this way anyway, how has the art of Wing Chun kind of progressed from the 70s and 80s up until now?
Well, I think it's really up in the air as to whether it's a progression or not. Once a martial art or any skill becomes part of pop culture and the public wants it, and there's a demand for it, there are a number of people that are going to hang out their shingle that may or may not be qualified. And I see this a little bit in jiu-jitsu, which is a second art for me, and in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And what was going on in the 90s, particularly in Brazil, is very different from the jiu-jitsu scene now. They've handled it in a very different way in jiu-jitsu. But in Wing Chun, I don't think it was really ready for prime time. I think you had X number of people in the world that knew the art. I think you had people that trained with Yip Man and, trained for a year or two, and then all of a sudden it becomes a very popular thing because of Bruce Lee. And so why not hang your shingle out and make a little extra money teaching what you know of Wing Chun? So there wasn't really much organization in how it spread throughout the world. Some of the young men that were in Hong Kong during those times in the 50s and 60s when Yip Man was in his prime teaching, they moved around the world. Some went to Germany, some went to England, some went to Australia, United States, and it really wasn't terribly accessible just anywhere. That's changed since the early 80s, when I started in 1983, in that it's much more available. I think that a number of people are quite good. There's actually some very good Wing Chun represented all around the world. And, of course, it's like anything else. You know, you have the good, the bad, and the ugly, and you have YouTube, where anybody is free to show absolutely everything they know or don't know. And so anyway, I think that, you know, Wing Chun had an innate momentum, just being what it was. And there was also the momentum of people wanting to learn it because of Bruce Lee, and curious about it, searching for it. And that led to a very open market and a varied quality of Wing Chun that was available. I think if you had good teaching, you were lucky. You were, being in the right place at the right time. I was lucky to have good teachers. I've been lucky to have good teachers my entire life, certainly in martial arts. They knew what they were doing. They knew how to fight with it, and they knew how to teach it. So applying this to the rest of your life is one of these things that develops with martial arts. But anyway, I think there was a great deal of enthusiasm in the late 70s and early 80s when Wing Chun became a little bit more available. In the first school I started Wing Chun, there were any number of black belts from a number of other schools because they wanted to learn Bruce Lee's art. It was that simple. And, of course, it created a great, great atmosphere because with good intention, you could spar with guys from other systems and learn a great deal. You could apply your Wing Chun, and they would they'd train hard with you. But it was all with good spirit. It would be difficult to replicate, I think, right now. I also think the public mentality is much different now than it was, say, at the death of Yip Man. People aren't really very aware of kung fu culture, martial arts, yes. But there are a lot of misconceptions about martial arts, and there certainly were back in the day, meaning back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And martial arts in the United States really hasn't spread, outside of judo and our own martial arts of boxing and wrestling, folk wrestling, there really wasn't much access to Asian martial arts. Certainly the Asian communities probably wouldn't teach anybody that wasn't Asian and didn't have a personal reference. But also, it was just hard to come by. And so when people would, after a while, people would be teaching and you'd have varied qualities of schools. There really isn't a governing body of Wing Chun. Wing Chun people haven't really organized well, I don't think, as a system. I think that in the early years, I think that there were some rivalries in Hong Kong and personal disputes that carried over as Wing Chun developed. And so you'd have this student of Yip Man's lineage, another student of Yip Man's lineage, and they weren't supposed to get along. And I think that anybody familiar with the Wing Chun scene is very much aware of Wing Chun politics and Wing Chun infighting. And I don't think that that's been very helpful. The art has spread, but it's spread in a very, it's just spread because people go different places. It's not because it wasn't done in an intentional way. There's no overarching strategy, and there's no governing body of Wing Chun. There's the Wing Chun Athletic, but they haven't really done much about with the Wing Chun in the world. They've certainly, they've got the Wing Chun Athletic Association in Hong Kong. Yip Man's first generation students still use the facility to teach. I think that was the idea. You can get, you can become a member of the Wing Chun Athletic, but they really have very little influence around the world. And I don't think anybody's provided that. With Japanese martial arts, they're usually governing bodies. The Koreans have done very well with Taekwondo working together. And I think that Wing Chun people have had trouble getting over personal rivalries rivalries of lineage through the years. They haven't been willing to work together. We've tried to do some tournaments, I don't think the result was that great. In many ways, I think the actual competition itself was just fine, but the brouhaha surrounding the tournaments that we participated in, the questionable judging, the favoritism of one group of sifus for their students as opposed to anybody else, I don't think that that's helped Wing Chun in any way, shape, or form to grow. I think that there have been some efforts to unify the system, but it's an uphill climb. So a wonderful system that has some great practitioners and teachers. It has good people around the world teaching Wing Chun, but people have not been able to work together to develop the art, to advance the art as a group. And I think that's been a little bit of that. That's had an effect on how Wing Chun is perceived now, and its future.
Okay. You mentioned something I wanted to ask you about. You mentioned some of the things that has kind of deterred the development of Wing Chun. I wanted to get your opinion on how is MMA, the emergence of MMA, and how does that impact Wing Chun? Because, you know, a lot of people say, you know, Wing Chun is a deadly art, and so it's not for competing. What are your opinions on that?
Well, you know, years ago, there's a precedent. The early karate tournaments, late 60s, early 70s, Joe Corley, Chicago's infamous Count Dante, and many other people who really were the backbone of these competitions, decided to compete. People were saying that somebody's going to get killed. These are deadly attacks. These are deadly strikes. This is not for competition. Well, nobody died. And actually, the competitions were quite successful. So, frankly, I think that with common sense, you can compete with pretty much anything. I mean, just turn on the TV and see some trash sports. So, you know, you can compete with anything. But with restraint, common sense rules, it would be very easy to have a good competition if people could actually participate in a fair and sportsmanlike manner. I wasn't terribly impressed with the sportsmanship of the other Wing Chun people that I encountered. There were a few people that knew how to compete. I come from an athletic background. I've been in sports on and off my entire life and played competitive soccer until I was 35. And, you know, it wasn't a nursery school, but essentially people came to play and finish the game. And to have a successful competition, to have a successful league and a successful tournament every year. And it's done in most sports, but that effort hasn't succeeded, partially because of what you mentioned. People are afraid. People feel that it's too deadly. And of course it has deadly elements, you know, but sticking your fingers in somebody's eye and chopping them in the throat, stomping on somebody's knee is just not very sporting. So that will put some people off. But I think that I don't think there's any reason why we couldn't compete. On the other hand, with MMA, and to address your question, MMA has had an interesting effect on martial arts. Most of the people competing are usually seasoned, well-trained martial artists, to say the least, and usually have absorbed some of the ethics involved in studying martial arts, which all of us struggle with. You know, you're dealing with things that can be deadly, that can harm other people, so you need to have morals and ethics accompanying it, meaning how you interact with other people, at what point you actually, is it ethical to use your martial art, and at what point, you know, you should usually be walking away from these, from any confrontation whatsoever. But I think with MMA, it's a pure sport. Let me walk that back. It's a sport, and it's designed for sport. If you were to ask Hickson Gracie, he would say that you could only use 30% of jiu-jitsu. It's a mix of a number of different things, and some people have used Wing Chun effectively. Anderson Silva has used Wing Chun and JKD techniques in his competitions, in his fights,
right.
And so have other people. But, you know, it's kind of like one of my more cynical friends said, nothing works, meaning that to compete in MMA, you have to have stand-up, you have to have grappling. What is the stand-up? A little boxing, some Thai boxing. It is mixed martial arts. It's focused on the sport. I'm sure that there are a lot of good lessons learned, life lessons learned in the training of it. But most martial arts have a philosophy and have values that are taught alongside the techniques, so that people get the idea subtly that getting into fights is stupid. It causes a lot of problems, particularly as you age past high school. And it's, you know, these days there's no telling what will happen if you start throwing punches. This could easily escalate into a much more violent situation involving weapons. So the world's changed a little bit as well. But I think that really you kind of miss the focus on martial arts values when training these things. If I have a student come in that's had some MMA, he generally has very little idea of how you should behave in a martial arts school, okay?
Right.
The ideas of respect, the ideas of seniority, the ideas of kind of like, until you get used to what's going on, eyes open, mouth shut, be there, learn, be respectful on the floor, all of that sort of stuff. I'm sure that people are very careful when they train MMA, particularly professionals. But I think there's a discrepancy between focusing on sport, focusing on competition, and here we get down to something, focusing on pure fighting. Martial arts ultimately are about working on yourself, making yourself healthy, fit, developing a healthy lifestyle, eating, sleeping well. It's also about helping people. Fighting is a major part of it, but on the other hand, it's not something you're going to do every day. In today's world, if you get into a fight once a year, you're probably pretty antisocial. And, you know, I mean, it's not like, you know, 40 years ago where people would get into a fight, it was just a fight. So, you know, even if you got into a fight once a year, 99% of your martial arts are going to be taken care of, are going to take place in the school where you study and train and in your own personal life training. You get a lot of alone time. You get a lot of time to test what you're doing and to reflect upon how that went. And there are a lot of obstacles. You're definitely rolling a rock uphill. It's not an easy thing to learn a martial art and to succeed and make it part of your life and do martial arts your entire life. It requires time. It requires the physical ability to do so. And it requires commitment. So I think that as we train martial arts, we discover all the other things that come with it. How to turn a weakness into a strength. You're terrible at something. This technique just doesn't work for you. And that may well be the case, but you can still get to where you can learn it. You can do it. You can file it for future reference. You can use it if it's something that fits your game. And you learn that by training, you can solve problems. And if that isn't a life lesson, I don't know what is. You also end up in a gym with a lot of different people. People in our gym rub shoulders with people with whom they'd rarely come into contact. Just because it's a diverse school and people are from different parts of the city and different economic strata. I think that's absolutely great because it broadens anybody that lives that way. You need each other. There's no time for personal problems with each other. There's no time for factionalization in the gym between this clique, like we're the good guys and we trained, you know, early on with Sifu. So, you know, it's a matter of who's training, who's working on things and who's in the gym. Once people develop past a certain point, they're expected to help each other. They're expected to bring the new people along. That's a very formal relationship in traditional Chinese Kung Fu. You have elder Kung Fu brothers and sisters who help the younger Kung Fu brothers and sisters negotiate the obstacles of beginning a martial art and developing as a martial artist. The teacher, the Sifu, the professor can't be everywhere at once, but you can all help each other. So we all become extensions of the same teaching. In Japanese martial arts, you have the same. You have the senpai-kohai relationship, senior and younger student. I think these things are valuable. It teaches you some very valuable social lessons, and you learn to become a good citizen in your own gym, and hopefully that spreads to your personal life, where you start thinking of the world around you and interacting mindfully with the people that you encounter every day, and try to negotiate situations with Wing Chun principles. If somebody's giving you a lot of hard energy and being very aggressive, it's possible to deflect it. You know, a little verbal jujitsu, I think, is what it's called often, or verbal aikido. Nobody ever says verbal Wing Chun, but certainly in our own circles we could, which is deflect. Don't directly confront. I mean, if you have to defend yourself verbally or physically, then you need to have your red line. Once somebody crosses it, it's time to do this. But until that point, you have lots of options, and you need to keep your ego out of the way as much as possible. We've all struggled with that.
Right. Right.
So
I want to touch on something. Go ahead.
It's just about, I think that ultimately we end up developing ourselves. Anyway, sorry.
Okay. Oh, no problem. I wanted to touch on something you said earlier about replicating the attitude that was back in the 70s and 80s about the excitement and wanting to learn Bruce Lee's art. How do we get to that or back to that? And then the second part of that question would be the future. What do you want to see as far as Wing Chun, the development, how the art can kind of elevate and progress a little bit more in the future?
Well, to address the first part of the question, I think we have to evolve past the 70s and 80s. Things have changed. Martial arts have changed massively since the 70s and 80s. I think that enthusiasm was the cause of it was the result of several things. Number one, martial arts, Asian martial arts, that is, were exotic and very cool. And, of course, they had pop culture supporting them. And by that, I mean kung fu movies, Hong Kong action movies. And certainly when I first started, most of the people that came in were kung fu movie freaks.
Yeah, I have to admit, I was and still am.
Yeah, it's fair enough. You know, I'm not too much of a kung fu movie fan, but I love samurai movies, all of them. So, you know, there's this cross-cultural fascination, and sometimes it was funny. People would come into the gym, and they'd act like they thought they were supposed to act in the movies, what they'd seen in the movies, you know. And, you know, you're in a martial arts gym with a bunch of athletes, a bunch of guys usually, you know, a few women are hopefully in the gym just to give it some civility. But, the last thing these guys are thinking about, you know, is, well, they may be thinking about it, but it isn't the Shaolin Temple.
Right.
You know, I mean, some of these guys would have stood outside of the door of my first teacher's school for 3 days just so they would have taught that he would teach them, because they saw that in the movies, you know. And, you'd run into that kind of stuff. And sometimes it was a little too much, but everybody was polite and treated each other very well. The enthusiasm was there. The knowledge was not as available as it is now. I'd like to think that there are more good Wing Chun teachers now than there ever have been, simply because, you know, whatever's going on out there, there's some people that are actually trained in the art. They're going to fall in love with it, and they're going to train as hard as they can and develop. Some people come to it early in life. Some people come to it in the middle of their life. Some people come to it late in life and see the benefits, love it, you know, and train hard. But I think, you know, the 70s and 80s were a mixture of availability, you know, the influence of kung fu movies and pop culture. I think it was a unique time. I don't think you could replicate a time where people, you know, you get two dozen black belts from other systems, school owners, coming into a Wing Chun gym and to learn Yip Man's art. You see a little bit of that, but not too much. You see people that want to add something to their game. But otherwise, they're often doing other things. I think there was a flurry, there was a phenomenon in the phenomenon was replicated in the 90s and the early 2000s in jiu-jitsu, but jiu-jitsu is separate from MMA. And MMA is separate from the Brazilian version of MMA, which is Vale Tudo. You know, if you hold to the way the competition is conducted. So anyway, the atmosphere now is very, very different. And I think it's up to us, in whatever system we teach as martial arts artists, to somehow communicate that which captured us back in the day, to transmit that enthusiasm, to show people the benefits of studying a martial art, in this case, a Chinese martial art. In addition to the art of Wing Chun, you have all of Chinese culture to deal with if you really, really want to. Now, some people take it a little bit too far and, you know, take on Chinese names or their kung fu name, which probably isn't too far, but, you know, it's a little much at times. But I think really you know it's a matter of what can it do for you? What can Wing Chun do for you? And we discussed this in the last podcast. But at the end of the day, it helps you work on yourself and it helps you interact with other people. It gives you better. It gives you confidence and also a quiet knowledge that you are willing to pay the price to learn something that is difficult and not everyone knows. You're going that extra mile to learn something. And these are easy benefits to get from martial arts if you show up and train. But I think that getting people to show up to train in a busy world, I mean, frankly, you know, we can talk about the 90s, the 2000s, and the roaring 20s that we live in right now. But, things change. And the martial arts have changed since the lockdowns and the pandemic. There's been a little bit of a drop-off in adult study and an increase in children's study. I mean, I think that's the work for some anthropologist or sociologist to figure that out. But that's just the way that we're dealing with it, what we have to deal with now as martial arts instructors. People also are less interested in learning a martial art to fight. In other words, there's enough information out there to where people can learn that martial arts are only partially about fighting. Initially, people come in to learn how to fight. But as they develop, they realize self-defense is putting it nicely. But yes, they do come in to learn self-defense. And also it depends on who's coming in. If you have a lot of younger people, late teens, early 20s, well, there's going to be a little bit more testosterone flowing around in the gym. And you got young guys that are going to want to go out and test themselves. And of course, that's only going to head in one direction, particularly in a city like Chicago. Okay. I mean, this is where I think competition could be very helpful, but let's try to come back to that later. But I think it's up to us to move past some of the old factional rivalries in lineage, uglier scenes in modern martial arts history that could easily be ascribed to these rivalries in Wing Chun, and actually just forget them, leave them in the past. They're not our arguments. I wasn't in Hong Kong in the 50s and the 60s. I did train in a gym in the early 80s, in the mid 80s, well, during the 80s, that was there was a lot of healthy competition. There was some unhealthy competition. There were people that didn't like each other, and it didn't take long to find that out. You know, I think we need to move past that. Number one, okay. I think that if you have competition, young people who want to test themselves have a way to test themselves that's healthy and controlled. If there are injuries, they can be controlled. Not like in a street fight where a street fight can get out of hand very, very quickly. And definitely mm-hmm. in a city like Chicago, New York, L.A., and, you know, other big cities, these things can get really out of line. But, you know, I think that competition would help bleed off that energy. It would also let instructors know that you need each other. We may not like each other. We may not get along. There may be history, but it's in everybody's good. It's for everybody's benefit that you train together and compete together. I've seen that work very well in jiu-jitsu, because certainly I know a lot of people in the Chicago jiu-jitsu scene, and jiu-jitsu developed Carlos Gracie Jr. Developed the IBJJF that developed a competition that ran on time and gave people a place to compete. 20 years ago, you'd be lucky to find 100 people at a jiu-jitsu tournament. Now, you know, 3,000, 3,500 at Pan Am's alone. Right. At the world competition, just, you know, it's packed because people want to test themselves. You have a short time in your athletic life in which you can do that at your peak, and people compete and people get along. Because basically Brazil or Rio in the 90s was pretty crazy with a lot of challenge fights and so forth going on. Not dissimilar from Wing Chun in Hong Kong. I think we could benefit from that experience and learn to work together. Learn to acknowledge each other's lineages, to accept differences in the way that things are taught. When you run across people that are saying this would be absolutely wrong, you can't do it this way, my teacher showed this, it's a fairly closed-minded attitude. I can show you three ways to do a jump sao, and I've seen all of them done within Yip Man's lineage. What does that mean? It means that there are options. It means that there are variants. That's normal. Plus, what artist in any artistic discipline is like even their idol? Somebody once asked Dizzy Gillespie how he developed his unique sound. And Diz said, well, I was trying to imitate, and I can't remember his idol, but he was trying to imitate somebody else and couldn't do it, but he came up with this. Which he said with a great deal of humor, but, you know, I mean, I think there are a lot of musicians that are like that. They're trying to imitate somebody, and you really can't imitate somebody. You have to be them. And, of course, once that really sinks in other words, you have to be somebody else, be yourself and evolve as a martial artist. Right. Just be yourself. Well, develop.
What I hear you saying is that we can really, with the different lineages and different styles, we can actually learn from each other and really promote the art.
Absolutely. My current Sifu, Grandmaster Samuel Kwok, he's always surprising because he's never refused his hands, which means when you're around Sam Kwok, you can't refuse hands either to anybody. but for instance, we were in Hong Kong and I saw him just put somebody in his pocket. And later we went out for a bite to eat and you know, I said, you know, I made some comment about it. And he said, did you see what he did? Did you see what he did?
Mm.
You know, he did something very cool. And I thought, well, it didn't work very well, you know, but I'm listening to my teacher and he's absolutely right. The guy had a great idea. Sam sussed it out right away, shut it down. That doesn't mean it's a bad technique. It just means that
right.
Sam Kwok is more experienced and a better, you know, a better Wing Chun practitioner, Chi Sao practitioner. In this case, it was a Chi Sao exchange. But, yeah, we have plenty to learn from each other. And also we have plenty to affirm in our own lineages. And for instance, in classical piano, there are a couple of methods of how you should have the angle of the wrist when you play the piano. Not that the piano and I ever got along, but I've heard some of these discussions with pianists. And
right. The
last thing they do is look at each other and go, you were a fool. You weren't taught properly. You know, you can't play. Well, you're actually talking to Vladimir Horowitz. I think he can play. You know, just because you disagree about something doesn't mean that that it can't be that it's not useful. And of course, I think, you know, at the risk of getting a little bit political, or at least our social climate now is such that people, if they disagree, they cut each other off.
Right.
They're not able to interact, disagree civilly. And, you know, I don't think people ever acted very civilly in a lot of Wing Chun situations. But this is a larger problem in our society. And I think society affects, culture affects martial arts. Culture affects art, and you're going to see the zeitgeist, the feeling of the times reflected in the art practiced, and you know, listen to the music of the 60s. You know, there was a lot going on then, and it was reflected in the songs, it was reflected in the way that people played, and a lot of things. And you know, I don't want to stray too far from the Wing Chun topic, but I think that we, you know, certainly in difficult times when people are not agreeing, I think that, I mean, this is an example we can bring to the table. I have people that come to me from other Wing Chun lineages, and if they have a good attitude, I'll accept them. If they listen, I'll accept them. Because when you come to me, you tell me you want to learn from me. I'm not providing a playpen for other Wing Chun people to come in and do what they've always been doing. They either need to contribute or they need to learn. And they need to also bring their uniqueness so that other people have different people to train with. And I think that we could actually end up, you know, with, you know, being I think martial arts schools can be a kind of center of stability to where, you know, Don, you know, you and I both know that there are a number of diverse political opinions in our gym. But by and large, we leave them off the floor. And by and large, everybody gets along. Well, everybody does get along very well because we keep it to the Wing Chun. And once class starts, there's too much to talk about anyway, rather than to, you know, find things to argue about. People in martial arts need each other. You need people to train with. And people don't always get along in any venue. I mean, think about what life's like where you go to work every day. Not everybody gets along. And in places where that's uncontrolled, people don't stick around long. You got to move on. I mean, if this is an unpleasant environment, in a pleasant environment, people learn to work together. We don't really have those kind of problems. Sometimes when newer people come in and their Wing Chun is very different, telling me that they're looking for something too. So I try to actually work with them and develop what they already know and skew it you know, in an area, to an area where I feel that I know what I'm doing. In other words, I'm confident in what I'm teaching. I'm confident in the Wing Chun that I teach. I'm confident in the philosophy, concept, and theory behind it, and I'm certainly confident in the practice of it and the use of it. But, you know, there's no reason that that people can't use these things to interact. One of the object lesson that really struck me right, just hit me right upside the head, was when we were doing tournaments. We did three tournaments in Cleveland before the fight broke out, right? But but what I noticed was that Sifus that didn't get along and their students were in a match together, number one, they were trying to do their best and they trained together and the matches were always fair. If somebody took a cheap shot, and sometimes it wasn't on purpose, people were just pumped up. None of these people were professional fighters. So, you know, nerves are going to take over and all of that. But I looked over and saw one of my fighters with a student of a Sifu that I didn't really get on that well with. They're over there talking. They don't need us anymore. These guys are young. They're the future. They're exchanging ideas about their techniques. And, of course, this I thought was fantastic because, really, these stupid, petty rivalries between lineages and between people, I mean, some of it is about money, which is unacceptable but understandable. You know, all these things mean nothing. It's the art itself that means something. And I think this is true with art across the board. I mean, we could do another show on whether martial arts are an art or not. But they're certainly very difficult, and they certainly have a lot of the same quality. Well, to learn them, you have to do the same thing you have to do in music. You have to practice, and you have to practice with good people, and you need to get good input to improve. You know, I kind of think that I think that we could actually, with, you know, as long as people are willing to put these things to the side, which so far they have not been able to do, I think that a lot of things could happen that are very positive for Wing Chun and very positive for traditional martial arts going forward.
Okay. All right. I know that we're going to have another episode to kind of talk about competition and how that would go about. Well, we have a few more minutes in this episode. I want you to give the location and the time of the school, the Philip Nearing School of Wing Chun in Chicago.
Okay. We're at 2643 West Chicago Avenue. We're in the same building as Rep's Gym. We are not in that facility, but we are in the building. Our logo is all over a door in front of the building. We have classes Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, group classes, that is. Group classes Tuesday and Thursday are 6 to 7 for beginners and 7:30 to 8:45 for intermediate advanced. Usually we run a little over with that second class because people are training hard and having a good time. Saturday morning, we have beginner's class from 10:45 to 11:45, followed by Qigong at noon, and intermediate advanced class from 12:30 to 1:45. Every other week, on Saturday, we hold an instructor's class to take care of the guys that give their time to help out the new people and other guys that are going to be carrying Wing Chun forward in the future, the frontline guys. So anyway, we have 6 Wing Chun classes, group classes per week. We have 1 Qigong class. And then throughout the week, Monday through Friday, I do private lessons during the day and actually early evening, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So we're busy 6 out of 7 days a week. Tomorrow we're going to have a seminar with a boxing coach who's also a Wing Chun practitioner and a good guy, a good friend of mine, good friend of ours. You know, we have a year-round schedule. We rarely deviate from that schedule unless Christmas falls on, you know, one of the school days.
Right, right. And give me your phone number and a email address or website.
Sure. Website is Wing Chun Chicago, one word, okay, wingchunchicago.com. The email address is wingchunchicago@gmail.com. And our phone number, excuse me, is 312-282-9571.
All right. I think that's going to wrap it up for this episode. I want to thank Sifu Nearing, as always, for the knowledge and history of Wing Chun. And we'll be back at you with another episode of the Phil Nearing All Things Wing Chun podcast. Take care.
Thanks.